Welcome to the Queensland Economy Watch special coronavirus edition. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. It's been an incredible day. We've had the rescue package announced by the Prime Minister and the Treasurer this morning, a $66 billion package. It's absolutely extraordinary. Joining me right now to chat about the rescue package and the impact of coronavirus on the Australian economy and the Queensland economy is my good friend and former Treasury colleague, Joe Brannigan, Director of Tulipwood Economics. Joe, how are you?
I'm well, Gene, given the circumstances. I'm in lockdown here at home in my office, as I understand you are, and the street's very quiet, and I think families are using plenty of bandwidth, downloading Netflix movies and streaming Foxtel.
Absolutely, and I don't have a TV, so I've been watching ABC live stream over the internet, and yes, I've been watching that very closely, and yes, it's absolutely extraordinary. So, Joe, we've been chatting a lot and emailing about what's going on with coronavirus. Just how bad could this be? You've done some analysis of what the death rates could be, what the numbers could be. Could you give us a flavour, please, of just how bad this could be?
Well, it's pretty sobering when you look at it. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, politicians are saying that their best medical advice is you're looking at, you know, 40, 50, 60% of the population being infected and you know, of those being infected, people are assuming around a 1% mortality rate, and that's quite frightening. I mean, if you look at the Australian population, we're just over 25 and a half million people now, so 10% of that, assuming what seems to be quite a good case, that's 2.5 million people infected, and even if you apply I think what is the lowest mortality rate going around the Singapore rate, which is 0.87%, that's still 22,000 deaths in a calendar year. And just to put that in context, in the 2018 calendar year, there were 158,493 deaths in Australia. And of those, 14,500 were caused by diseases of the respiratory system. And of those, 3,000 were caused by influenza and pneumonia. So even if we assume only 10% get infected and slightly less than 1% mortality, that 22,000 deaths, which will add to the 158,000, is, you know, almost twice as large as the current death rate for diseases of the respiratory system. So, you know, this is quite serious, I think, and it just, you know, the cases get worse and worse. I mean, you know, if you were to apply a 50% infection rate, then you're looking at, you know, an absolute national tragedy. So it's clear why the government's moving fast to enforce these quite draconian measures for a liberal democracy to enforce social distancing and you know, basically shutting down the economy. So, you know, I think the next few weeks we'll understand, or the next probably week or two, we'll understand how steep that curve is rising and, you know, as the death rates start to come in, and hopefully we flatten the curve so that the growth rate in deaths will be slow, or slower than what otherwise would be.
Yeah, absolutely. We really need to flatten that curve, as they say. Could I just ask you about the package that was announced today? I mean, there's a lot in it, so we won't go through it element by element. There's just too much in it to go through in this session we're going to have. But could you just give us your thoughts on whether this is a good package or not? How do you feel overall about the package, Joe?
Well, in terms of the size of the package, it looks it looks about right if you were trying to avoid the economy going backwards. But it's really very hard to tell, because the problem with making predictions here is that the measures, the social distancing measures, are changing every day. So, you know, you need to redo your analysis of the economic impact every time a more draconian measure comes in. For example, if schools close, I mean that will have a massive effect. Today the New South Wales and Victorian governments have indicated that schools may well close from early next week, and all non-essential businesses will shut down. Well, you know, if that happens, this package may not be large enough. Just to give you a sense of the size, so at the moment, you know, we're almost a $2 trillion economy. We're almost there, but basically our production is $480 billion a quarter. So this $64 billion package is rolled out $26 billion in the June quarter and $36 billion in the September quarter, and then $5 billion and less and less amounts going forward. So it's $64 billion out of a $1.8 trillion economy. It doesn't seem much, but in quarterly terms, you're looking at a 5% kind of boost to GDP in the June quarter and a 7% boost to GDP in the September quarter. And over the calendar year, which is, you know, the $1.8 trillion economy, it's about a 3.4% boost to GDP. So I think quite clearly, the package is, I think, quite well designed in terms of where it's targeting, you know, small businesses, trying to save jobs, keeping everything liquid and solvent. But it looks like, they're trying to do enough to avoid a recession. And when you're talking about, packages as big as 5% and 7% of GDP, I mean, that's, you know, they're depression numbers. I mean, if you take that stimulus away, it would be catastrophic what would happen to the economy.
Absolutely. So by a depression, you mean something something worse than a recession, the normal trough in economic activity we have with the business cycle. You're talking about the possibility of a 1930s style collapse of the economy when you have unemployment in the order of 20 to 30%. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Well, without those stimulus measures and with the shutdown of the economy, how could you possibly avoid that? I mean, that's how serious it is. Then you get problems with the, you know, permanent and long-term unemployed, and it just takes so long to climb for the economy to climb back and to function normally. And that's why the government is quite justified in what it's doing. But, you know, if a recession is defined as two quarters of negative growth, which could be as small as, 0.1% of negative growth, and the government has these packages of more than 5% of GDP in terms of its impact per quarter, obviously that's much larger than fighting off a recession, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I might ask about some of these individual measures, not all of them. What about what they're doing for job seekers, this temporary super new start, where they're doubling the payment for a limited period? I think it's 6 months or however long this lasts. What are your thoughts on that, Joe? Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, if it's time limited and the idea is simply to boost spending in the economy or to cushion the blow so that people are spending money, then it would be, it's a good transmission mechanism. But if you thought about it more deeply than that, in terms of, you know, in terms of incentives or in terms of, you know, who's receiving this money, you know, are they still living at home? Are they still living with their families? I mean, there probably would be a lot of problems if you thought about this from a public policy perspective. But all of that has really gone out the window. I mean, what we're trying to do is find, you know, the quickest and the easiest ways to get money back into the economy to keep people spending. So as a transmission mechanism, it's great. As long-term public policy, it obviously would have a lot of problems. But, you know, the government has announced that it's time limited. So I think, you know, the government is the rule book's gone out the window, Gene. I mean, in terms of thinking about these things from a kind of a microeconomic or incentive-based framework or a public policy framework, that's all gone out the window. It's really, you know, how do we keep people in jobs? How do we get money to people? How do we underpin the liquidity of the economy? And that's why the Reserve Bank's playing an ever greater role in this to make sure that businesses can still function, even though there's no production from a lot of these businesses. That they're just, you know, we're trying to get wages to people so that they can still spend.
Yep, absolutely. Look, the amount that they're going to be spending on this new job seeker payment or this special coronavirus supplement, it's a lot more than I ever expected. I thought they'd have to increase the payment to job seekers because there have been a lot of concerns expressed about Newstart and how much that pays. It hasn't increased in real terms in 25 years. The Treasurer the other day said that they're not going to be making any changes that bake in additional expenditure in the long term. Looking at this, though, how difficult is it going to be for the government to go back to the previous level of Newstart?
Yes. I mean, it might be this massive step up in nominal terms, and then they hold it fixed for the next 20 years, so that it falls in real terms. But you're right. I mean, that's one of the problems. And but you know, as I said, we're not thinking about this from a kind of a public policy. You know, we're not doing cost benefit appraisals. We're not doing RISs. We're not doing regulatory impact statements of each of these measures. We're simply looking for, the kind of easiest way with the least resistance to get money into people's hands. So, you know, of course, in normal times, I think on balance, it would be a bad idea from a public policy perspective, because there are reasons why you keep Newstart as low as possible, of course, to try and encourage people into work. But, you know, at the moment, it's almost like we need to hold everything together while the health crisis pass and until we get to the other side of this. And therefore, some of that, you know, more sober analysis that you'd get from the Productivity Commission is just gone out the window for now.
Yep. So what some of the critics will point out, I suppose, is that you'll end up with businesses and households coming to expect this type of assistance whenever there is a crisis of some kind. And what we don't know at this stage is just how frequently this type of thing will occur. Is it just a once in 100 years thing, or with greater travel, is it now going to be once in every 20 years or 30 years or whatever? We just don't know. So that's what
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, you may remember some of the Productivity Commission reviews into drought assistance, and the argument there that the Productivity Commission was making was, well, you know, if this is a permanent thing, then, you know, farms and businesses need to scale to a size where they can deal with these things. If it's regular, then the assistance needs to be, you know, baked into the budget. Or farms need to be managed in a way to, you know, minimise the costs of drought. So it's the same thing with pandemics, and, you know, you and I, we're not epidemiologists, we're not pandemic experts, so we simply don't know how often these events will hit. The Prime Minister says this is a once in a 100-year event. We had the flu pandemic in 1918, just after World War One, which spread across the world as soldiers were returning home, Australian soldiers returning home from Europe. We've had subsequently a number of bad flus in the 50s, 60s. We've had the recent SARS, and which, you know, is nowhere near as costly or deadly as this COVID-19. But, I don't think we can, it'll be for people further down the track to assess, is this increasing the likelihood of these pandemics?
Yep. Okay. So overall, I tend to agree with you. I think this is the sort of thing that, broadly speaking, needs to be done. The rule book has been thrown out temporarily, and that means that things that were once considered really unthinkable, in my view, so this policy of allowing early access to superannuation, I know we've always allowed it in exceptional circumstances, but now we're going to be allowing it if people, they're in financial hardship because of this coronavirus. I didn't see that coming. Do you have any thoughts on that, Joe?
I think there was a lot of pressure on Talkback Radio. It's my understanding, and that filtered through to the people that matter in Canberra. I mean, not everyone is on the superannuation bus, and there's certainly been criticisms about our super system. If you read, for example, Judith Sloan or Adam Crichton in The Australian, I mean, a number of commentators have criticised our system. I mean, the fact is we designed this system. It was meant to support people in retirement, without relying on the pension, which, is a rapidly increasing component of the federal budget, I think 10, 11, 12% of the federal budget. But it hasn't worked. The modelling says that up to 80% of people will still need a full or partial pension in the future. And, we need to think about this. I mean, we're taking 9 or 10% of our income today, and as you know, people value today more than tomorrow, putting it away for retirement. Some people don't make it to retirement. They die before they get to retirement. Some people, have financial hardships during their working life where they would prefer to have their super. You get fluctuations in financial markets where, your super balances are going up and down, when really what people want is some kind of defined benefit scheme that's provided by the pension. So I think although most people still support our super guarantee system, I think more and more commentators are criticising it, and I think that has made it easier for the government to make that decision. And as Josh Frydenberg said today, he said, after all, it's the people's money and they need it now more than when they retire. So, I think that's a good decision.
Okay. Yesterday, Joe, you sent me a link to an article quoting John Daly, CEO of the Grattan Institute, and John was essentially arguing for a almost complete shutdown of Australia for the next 4 or 8 or 12 weeks or whatever it was, however long it takes to actually stop this coronavirus.
Yes.
Do you think the PM slapped him down today? It was a bit subtle, but he said, well, he didn't name John Daly exactly, but there was a line in his speech today where he's basically saying, well, we're not going to do that. That doesn't make any sense.
Yes, I think he did. I think he rejected it. And I think, John Daly's argument that you can't finesse this, well, I think you can finesse this. I mean, the fact is that, people die every day. There's 434 people die every day. You know, 40 people die a day from diseases of the respiratory system. There will be deaths from coronavirus, and I think it's something that we have to balance a lot here. We have to balance, you know, trying to flatten that curve against trying to maintain people's livelihoods and maintain, you know, the freedoms we enjoy in a democracy. And it's something we are trying to finesse and trying to evaluate the costs and benefits every day. And, you know, sure, from a strictly health point of view, you know, I remember, I'm pretty sure the first coronavirus case was on the Gold Coast over the Australia Day weekend, I think I remember now. You know, in theory, we could have shut down the whole country then. We could have shut it down before the Australia Day weekend. But, you know, those costs would be just enormous. I mean, you'd be closing your economy for at least 6 months. So, you know, I don't think it's right to say, oh, you can't finesse this. You know, we can finesse it. We have to be realistic. There will be people that will die. There have been. There's seven already. And, you know, it's a politician's job to find a way through to balance competing interests and try and somehow balance, you know, that, you know, kind of all these draconian laws about social distancing to try and reduce the number of deaths against keeping the economy going. And that is the very job that we elect parliamentarians for. And, you know, while we have the government that we do. So I think the Prime Minister was right to reject what John Daly was saying.
Yep. Gee, that was extraordinary when he said that the government and the National Cabinet may have to consider more draconian measures. I was stunned that he used that frank language. That said, I think it probably needs to be done, and we will see some more draconian measures coming out of this National Cabinet meeting tonight, I expect. Would you agree, Joe?
I think so. I mean, it sounds like, you know, I don't know whether there's a split in the National Cabinet, but it sounds like Victoria and New South Wales are very keen to almost completely shut down their economies, and it sounds like schools will close from Tuesday in Victoria. That's been announced. Now, the school holidays come a week earlier in Victoria than in Queensland, so that makes it a lot easier to do, of course, but my sense is that to ensure the solidarity of the National Cabinet, that Queensland will just fall into line and the other states. So, you know, my bold prediction is that schools will probably shut down early next week in Queensland. I mean, the interesting thing, I mean, I know just anecdotally, just talking to the school principal at my daughter's school, that Education Queensland are working very hard to, you know, get all the material ready so that kids can learn at home and online in term two, but I'm just not sure they're ready yet. So Queensland may want to keep the doors open another week just to make sure they've got everything lined up so that kids can learn from home in term two. But I think if, you know, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Gene, but I think Victoria just in the last couple of hours announced that schools will close next Tuesday. New South Wales, yep, I think, will very likely follow suit. So it just puts a lot of pressure on Queensland. I mean, you know, if Victoria and New South Wales announce that, then you can imagine a lot of parents of Queensland kids just voting with their feet. I know, picking up my daughter from school last week, I would say, I think my daughter said there were 16 in the class of normally 26. So, you know, not quite half, but, you know, a significant, no, 10 out of 26 being away late last week.
Yep, yep. And Norman Swan, the ABC health commentator, he's adamant that we should shut the schools down. It seems to me that the main reason the government or the federal government and the state governments wanted to keep them open is so that they can effectively provide childcare for their key workers, for their nurses and doctors. So they just have to solve that problem. So what we'll probably see is these schools open with a skeleton staff where they're just there to look after the children of those key workers?
I think so, and that's what they've done in the UK. And I mean, the interesting thing coming out of the UK is, I think last Monday week, that you know, the chief scientist or chief medical officer in the UK said, you know, we need to keep schools open. That does more. That's more good than bad. For you know, for those reasons, parents of some kids, you know, in the medical workforce, you know, sometimes grandma or grandpa is the one looking after the kids, and that's not good. You know, it keeps that kind of continuity. But the thing that was, I guess, unsaid or not so explicitly stated was this idea of trying to develop what's called herd immunity through the population by having the kids together, and you know, they only have mild symptoms if they're picking up the virus. But that subsequently went out the window about 4 days later, and I think that's why Boris Johnson last Friday reversed that decision and closed the schools for everyone except critical care workers, because some subsequent modelling of keeping those schools open to try and get that herd mentality showed that the costs exceeded the benefits and there would be a significant increase in mortality. So given that, I think either the Prime Minister or the Health Minister, someone in Australia, I remember, mentioned that press conference from the UK CMO and chief scientist, you know, supporting their decision, and 4 days later the UK's reversed that decision. So I think that's led us to what's happening today and what will probably happen tonight. But you know, it doesn't give parents much time to plan. I mean, you know, if school's called off Tuesday, okay, you go to school Monday, you empty your kid's desk. You know, what do? You try and get all the photocopies you can of little projects the kids can do. You've got to get kind of where's the online learning material. You know, if kids are younger, like prep or grade one or grade two, do they have login access? Do you have your passwords ready? You know, so there's it seems like it's going to be a huge rush if school in Queensland's called off early next week. You know, my sense is they need another week just to get everything organised so that this kind of home learning in term two will run smoothly. Not to mention the fact that parents will need to organise, or at least the parents of critical care workers, emergency service workers, will need to organise, you know, how they're going to, you know, look after the kids and go to work as well, unless they keep some schools open. Or do they keep every school open and they're just, you know, there's only 10 or 20% of the kids going? You know, sounds like a lot of decisions, you know, that need to be made in the next couple of days.
Yep. Both you and I are huge fans of Winston Churchill. This is like wartime, isn't it? I mean, this is exactly the type of decision making you have to make under pressure in a short time frame. This is what Churchill had to do back in wartime, isn't it?
It's exactly that. And you know, and Churchill had his wartime cabinet, which was, I think, five people, and it was across party lines. And, you know, they needed to meet every day, and they had, you know, they had a lot less, I guess, reliable information coming into them every day. You know, it was just extraordinary what Churchill was able to do in through May, June 1940 to turn things around, and or, you know, through the latter half of 1940 and 1941. And you know, and in a way, this is the moment for our politicians to really, you know, show leadership. And and you know, this is why we pay them the big bucks, right? This is their time, and they really need to be working around the clock and you know, assessing the scientific information and trying to balance that against, you know, broader public policy, you know, demands such as keeping the economy going. But wouldn't it be great to have Winston with us today, Gene, to...
absolutely, yes, yes.
To tell us everything's going to be all right. And
yeah.
But
well, I think
we don't.
I think the PM is stepping up. I was impressed by the press conference with Frydenberg this morning, and Greg Hunt, the federal health minister, is doing a superb job. I think Palaszczuk, our premier, is also doing a good job. So we've just got to see how this develops over the next week or so, and just hope for the best. Hope that we have some slowing in the COVID-19 cases. So just got to hope for the best. Joe, I better let you get back to your family, and I'm so appreciative that you took some time to chat with me on Sunday afternoon. This is such an important issue. This is such a big challenge for our country, and I'm really grateful for chatting with you about the issues today. So thanks so much.
Anytime, Gene. I'll be here in lockdown anytime you need me, my friend. So
good stuff, Joe.
We'll talk soon.
Absolutely.